My castaway this week is a novelist. She published her first book more than 40 years ago and has produced them at the rate of nearly one a year since then. She describes her work as a kind of coded autobiography, and her readers can try to trace her life in children's books such as Carrie's War and The Peppermint Pig, and in adult novels like Afternoon of a Good Woman and Circles of Deceit, for which she was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. All writers are liars, she said. They make use of their own tragedies to make a better story. She is Nina Borden. A lot of us are guilty of that, of course, Nina. We exaggerate things that have happened to us in order to make them more interesting. We embroider the story. The price you pay is you lose touch with the truth. Is that what's happened to you in your life? Do you cease to know what's true?
I think usually I know when something is developed from a story. The truth has got a bit twisted, if you like. But I don't always.
But what you also have to have is a very acquisitive memory, isn't it? You have to be the sort of person who files away, and perhaps you have done all of your life, even as a child, all the little details and little tales that you're told.
Oh, I think you file away. But I think also, you see, as you do write, of course, what you're doing is mining, if you like, your own childhood, your own past, so that the more you do it, the more you can do it, and the more you find. I mean, it's all practice, in a way.
Because The Peppermint Pig was something your grandmother told you about, wasn't it?
Well, yes, it was. That is a true story. But, of course, my grandmother told me the story, and my mother told me the story, and in doing so, they probably changed it a little. But there's no question that there was a pig that was a pet, and his name was Johnny. There's also no question that my grandmother's mother's neighbour was a lady called Granny Greengrass, who had her finger chopped off at the butcher.
Tell me again how that happened. It's a very good story.
Well, she had her finger chopped off at the butcher when she was buying a leg of lamb. And she put out her finger to show where she wanted the joint to be cut. But then she decided she wanted a bigger or a smaller piece and pointed again. Unfortunately, Mr. Grummet, the butcher, was bringing his sharp chopper down, and he chopped straight through her finger, my grandmother said, and it flew like a snapped twig into the corner of the shop. My grandmother was a little girl when this happened.
So it did really happen?
It did really happen, and it had a terrible sequel, because she wanted to see the chopped-off finger, but old Mrs. Greengrass always kept it in a glove or hidden by her skirt. But then old Mrs. Greengrass died, and my grandmother's mother was sitting, not by the corpse, but downstairs. And my grandmother went upstairs, hoping she could see the chopped-off finger, because the woman would be dead now. And she crept into the room, and she turned the bedclothes back. And there this woman lay, cold and white. And so my grandmother was terrified and ran down again. But her mother knew where she'd been, and she said a little later, "Now, Edith Emily, you must go upstairs to the front room and bring me my thread that is on the chest of drawers in front of the window." And so she had to go into this room again, where she'd left the It was a terrible, terrible punishment.
I thought that the poor old woman also had the best payoff line herself, though. Didn't she say, "It's all my fault because I changed my mind about which bit of the meat I want"?
That's right. I mean, I could never make up my mind and stick to it, she said.
But does that mean, you know, because you use all of these stories, that you can sit down at your typewriter, because, as I've said, you write children's books as well as adult books, can you travel at will up and down through your life?
Yes, I didn't realise it was what I was doing for ages. And then suddenly I did realise that, in fact, I moved about in time continuously.
Let's move you off to a desert island. Tell me about the first record that you'll play there.
Well, the first record I would like would be one of the poems of A.E. Housman set to music, because when I lived in Montgomeryshire during the war for a while, I used to walk across the hills, or ride across the hills, actually, and shout the A. Housman poems aloud, because, you know, they're perfect for that area.
When I was 21, I heard a wise man say, "Give crowns and pounds and guineas, but not your heart away. Give pearls away and rubies, but keep your fancy free." But I was one
George Butterworth's When I Was 1 and 20, sung by John Cameron, words by A.E. Housman. Nina Borden, Carrie's War is arguably your most famous book. It was dramatised by the BBC in the 70s about two children who were evacuated to Wales during the war. It's a magical story, semi-autobiographical. But your own experiences, it seems to me, when you were evacuated, were really rather harsher. I mean, there was one very sinister place you were in where you were locked in by sort of ball and chain.
Oh, yes, it was sinister, I suppose. But you see, I was 14 and I had my best friend Jean with me, and she was 14 too. And you can put up with an awful lot when there are two of you and you're that sort of age. And it was very strange to be living with these rather peculiar people who locked the front door with about 9 bolts, I think, and who wouldn't let us eat with them and served us separately, and we had to be terribly quiet on Sundays.
And then there was another billet, because you had a lot of billets.
Seven
billets. There was another one where you had to wash their dirty handkerchiefs.
That was very disagreeable, and that was the first one, and I was on my own there, which made that really quite uncomfortable. But on the other hand, again, you know, you thought this is what you have to put up with, and because my father was on North Sea Patrol, I felt that one shouldn't make any complaints anyway.
In Carrie's War itself, I mean, again, it's a much lighter business, it seems to me, but again, part of it is reflected in the reality of your experience, that you couldn't run up and down stairs because you might wear out the stair carpet in
Absolutely true. That happened in another billet, where my friend and I were not allowed to go upstairs to the bathroom in the middle of the day in case it wore out the stair carpet. And the woman used to rush about like a frenzied ferret, saying, messing and humbugging about, up and down, in and out, wearing out the stair carpet, messing and humbugging about, like a kind of mantra.
But you say you took it all in your stride, age 14. We wouldn't expect 14-year-olds now to take it in their stride. It does seem to me to have been quite a dramatic experience to be sent somewhere, away from your parents, to be stood in a hall, to be chosen by local people, or perhaps not chosen, is more painful. A very, very dramatic experience.
Well, as I say, it was quite an adventure at our age. And I lived in a suburb of London that I thought I'd been brought up to think was rather dull. And indeed it was. And this was a tremendous excitement.
And when you saw it all recreated by the BBC on television, what did that make you feel? Did it make you feel you were back there again? Did it?
Well, it was strange in a way. It sort of took away my own memories, because it made concrete something that I'd written. I had the town in my mind's eye and the children in my mind's eye. And now there were the different children, actors. And the town was different. Actually, the town wasn't different. The town was the one I was thinking about. But it does look different from my memory.
Record number two.
Well, record number two is the Welsh National Anthem. When we were living in Aberdare, we used to walk across the mountains and go and listen to political speeches in Merthyr Tydfil. And once I heard Aneurin Bevan speak, and he was wonderful. And we were all tremendously fired with the wickedness of the Conservative rule in the 30s, you see. And we were all very idealistic and keen for things to be put right later. And we walked back over the mountains and we sang, I can't say it in Welsh anymore, I could then, Land of My Fathers. And it was the most uplifting sound.
Oh,
Land of My Fathers, sung at the first festival of 1,000 Welsh male voices in 1969. Tell me, Nina Borden, about life in Essex before and after the war. Nothing to compare with evacuation. A dull business, was it?
Well, it wasn't dull when I was young, because when you're young, nothing is dull. I mean, the ordinary suburban streets are full of excitement and strange people, and you live an inner life in any case. At least I did, I think. And we didn't have much chance to listen to music, so, I mean, some of my choices are not very musically educated. Perhaps that's why we didn't have a radio. My mother thought it would interfere with our homework. And so we used to sit sometimes with our ears pressed against the dividing wall between our house and the next door one, so that we could hear things like the boat race, which, of course, not knowing about Oxford and Cambridge, we were still very devoted to. My mother bought a radio in the end so that we could hear Edward VIII abdicate, because she said that was an important historical moment. And all we knew was the song that we used to sing at school, which was Hark the Herald Angels Sing, Mrs. Simpson's Pinched Our King. But my mother thought more highly of it than that.
What did you then have in mind for yourself when you were a girl in the 30s? Where did you intend life should lead you? Do you think you thought it through? You did intend to avoid the local secondary mod at all costs.
Well, my mother made quite sure I did. I hadn't got any high-flown ideas for myself. I used to write plays for my toy theatre. I think I thought I'd like to write something, but what I thought I'd really like to do would be a famous journalist, possibly a foreign correspondent. You know, crawling through enemy lines with my camera. Perhaps I wanted to be a photographer as well.
Some more music. What's this, number three?
Ah, well, this is La Ci Darem La Mano. When I went to Oxford, unexpectedly and really at the behest of my best friend's mother, I didn't, as I say, know much about music, but one of the things that everybody sung, including one young man I was very much in love with, was La Ci Darem La Mano. And I didn't know what it was. I thought it was a love song. And then when I got married for the first time and went on a honeymoon to Zurich, we went and watched Don Giovanni. And I discovered it was really a dreadful seducer who was trying to drag this poor girl off to his castle.
La Ci Darem La Mano, Dominirai di si.
Thomas Hampson and Barbara Bonney singing the duet La Ci Darem La Mano from Mozart's Don Giovanni with the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam, conducted by Nicolas Arnoncourt. So on we move through your life to your Oxford interview at Somerville, and a story I don't think you've used in your books. You were intimidated from the start by the other applicants, I think.
Well, yes, they were very grand girls, you see. I mean, they came from somewhere like Cheltenham Ladies' College, I would imagine. And they all had best clothes on. You know, people wore them with sort of gory skirts and little edge-to-edge jackets. And they had rather sort of smart shoes. And I was wearing my school uniform because really it was all I had.
Your Essex gym slip.
My Essex gym slip. And I felt really rather sort of out of it. And they all spoke in these high, clear voices. And they went in one after the other to see Helen Derbyshire, who was the principal. And they came out and said to each other, my dear, wasn't she too dreadfully awful? I don't think I could bear it. I must go home. I must go and have a cup of tea and things like this. Well, I was rather terrified, really, because it seemed to me that nothing could be worse than these dreadful girls. And if they were frightened, then I was going to be petrified. And I went in, and there was nobody in the room at all except a nice little lady who sat by the fire with a rather red face, and she got at her feet and put out her hands and said, "Come in, dear child, I've been looking forward to meeting you." So I thought, well, this is very nice, and I sat down, and she gave me some tea and a chocolate biscuit, and then she asked me about myself, and she asked me about the farm where my mother was living, and how I knew about farm subsidies, which was something I'd written about in my entrance exam. And then she said, was I interested in poetry? And I told her all about A. E. Housman, and I thought he was the most wonderful poet in the whole world. And she said, had I read any Wordsworth? And I said, no. Well, I read some, I said, but I thought he was really rather sort of dull, pompous.
Romantic tosh, I think,
I said. And she heard me out very patiently, and she smiled and said, well, of course, he was an acquired taste, and perhaps I would come to Wordsworth when I was a little older. And then she kissed me on both cheeks and said, I think you would enjoy being here with us, dear girl. And I went. And it wasn't till long afterwards, well, not actually, it was my teacher at school, as soon as I got back and reported, who said, but didn't you know she was a great Wordsworth scholar? Well, no one had told me.
And you got your place.
I got my place.
Let's spool on through Oxford to your meeting there with two contemporaries. Richard Burton first. He asked you out, I take it.
Oh, yes. He asked me out to tea, which may sound strange coming from him, but he was only 17.
I thought he invited you away for the weekend with him.
Yes, he did, on that occasion. He said he knew Emlyn Williams, which I knew was a dead lie. I thought I could spot a lie when I heard it.
So this was definitely a euphemism for taking you off to bed somewhere, was it?
Well, I don't know. I have really no idea. He asked me to go and spend a weekend with him in Emlyn Williams's flat. So I didn't get beyond, I didn't think about his motives. I merely thought to me he wouldn't know Emlyn Williams, which of course was very stupid of me.
But why didn't you go?
Oh, well, he was a bit young, and he had boils. One boil on the back of his neck. Anyway, he was too young. Anyway, people didn't do that sort of thing, you see, because you might get pregnant.
And then there was a plump, neat, solemn girl with a pretty China doll smile.
Oh, that was Margaret Roberts.
Who was to become Margaret Thatcher.
Oh, yes, she did become Margaret Thatcher, but that was, yes.
And how did you get on with her?
Well, we didn't, to speak, really get on, because, I mean, we didn't know each other. We didn't mix in the same areas and that sort of thing. But we did Firewatch together once, and I had an argument with her about politics, which I pointed out to her that she would have a jollier time if she joined the Labour Club than she was having in the Conservative Club, because clearly she wasn't going to be won over by my socialist talk. And she said, I'm not playing at politics like you, Nina. I intend to get into Parliament, and this is the best way to do it.
Let's have record number four.
Well, this is Bob Dylan and the times they are changing. Really, because this was the 60s when my children were growing up, 60s and 70s, when they were growing up into a slightly different world, the one I'd grown up with, where you didn't go up to London to stay in Emlyn Williams' flat with anyone. I suspect they all would have. And this does seem to me an appropriate song.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times they are a-changing. Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming, for the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing.
Bob Dylan and the times, they are a-changing. Having said that you have taken many of your fictional situations from your own life, your first novel, which was published when you were 27, Who Calls the Tune, is written in the first person as a man who has murdered his twin sister, which is, you know, an extraordinary subject, an extraordinary technique for a first novel.
It was very difficult I think, because of the war. One didn't really feel that one had anything important to say if you hadn't been a fighter pilot or an air raid warden or something, at least, to do with the war. All I'd ever done was to help on the farm, which is not quite the same thing. And somehow one would embarrass to write about oneself or about things that one knew about. And so also because I was serious about being a writer in the same way that Margaret Roberts was serious about being a politician, I thought the thing to do was to learn one's craft and do it inside a convention so that you could then do the things you wanted to do with sort of guardrails on either side.
Yes, I can see that it would be a good disguise, as it were, but
yes.
For someone who was essentially quite timid about writing. But at the same time, you've got to have a certain assurance to write about these things about which you know nothing.
Well, of course, I'd read Graham Greene. He had a way of making one feel one knew all sorts of seedy things that one didn't actually know.
And by the time you'd finished it, were you proud of it? Were you convinced people would want to read it?
I just didn't know. I hadn't told anybody I was writing it, you see.
When did you do it? Because you had two small children.
Well, I wrote it when I was pregnant with the second, actually. I wrote it at night. I wrote it when I got up to see to them. I wrote it when my husband was at work. I think I did tell him at the end. And then I packed it up and sent it off to Collins.
But you were, so you were quite ruthless about needing to write, wanting to write, and were determined to fit it in at every odd corner.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, I didn't want to do anything else, really.
So you sent it off to Collins?
Yes. And then I had a letter back almost at once from George Harding, who was ran the crime club, who invited me up to see him. And this was one of the most exciting days of my life.
What did he offer you?
Well, he offered to publish it, which was amazing to me.
And money too?
And money too. Not very much money, you know.
How much?
£75.
Which was 1953, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it's a reasonable amount of money. And in fact, it sold out, and so I got some more money, which was really rather delicious.
And they called you their new find?
William Collins called me his new find.
Heady stuff.
Very heady stuff, yes. Nancy Spain said things like, "Move over, Agatha Christie."
How wonderful. Record number five.
Well, record number five is Beethoven's Symphony number 9, the bit before the choral, which I think is now the European anthem, and I'm a convinced European.
Part of the final movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 9, played by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Joseph Cripps. It was in the early 60s, Nina Borden, when by then you were an established writer, that you began to notice that your son Nicky, by then an adolescent, wasn't functioning properly. What were the first signs of his problems?
He became woolly-minded. He didn't get up in the morning. He was very difficult keep clean, and having his hair cut, you know, was beyond all diplomacy.
But beyond all the normal problems?
Beyond the normal problems, I think. Well, we thought so in any case, and so did the school. And so we went to a psychiatrist who said that he had an ordinary adolescence depression, no more.
And how long was it before you realised it was rather more than that?
Quite some while. I mean, he was obviously finding life extremely difficult. He'd been expected to get a scholarship to Oxford, but originally he didn't. He went instead to Kent and seemed to have really quite a happy year. And he made friends but he was obviously, we thought he must be on drugs. And at the end of the first year, he instead of going off with his friends, he went and worked in Whitbread's brewery in London. And he was obviously extremely withdrawn and strange. And we went to see him and we were anxious to find out whether he was taking drugs or not. And when we sort of half suggested it, he lectured us at great length on the evils of LSD. He knew people who were taking LSD and how foolish they were.
But he was conning you, was he?
He was conning us completely. We had always believed him. You know, he was the most truthful person.
And eventually he was diagnosed as a schizophrenic.
Not until he landed up in prison. He had a breakdown. He tried to kill himself. He went to a local hospital where they weren't sure what was wrong with him. And then he got picked up by the police who said he'd been dealing in drugs, which I don't think, in fact, was true. But anyway, he was sent to prison because he wouldn't appeal against his sentence. Then he was sent from the prison to a secure mental unit at the Westminster. And after that, he seemed to get quite a lot better. We lived with a girlfriend. And then he came back to live with us. And then he went off to a crisis centre because he was feeling so very ill that he thought they might help him. And from there, he killed himself.
And how did he kill himself?
He took a taxi to Putney, and I suppose he jumped in the river. And he was disappeared for 3 months, I think. And then I wrote to the duty officer at Scotland Yard and said, would they please look for him? I knew that they had got him on the computer, but people don't always look at the computer. And within 2 days, the inspector from Wapping was round at the BBC to tell my husband that they'd fished him out of the river 2 months before.
Hmm. Obviously, it's the most painful experience that any parent can go through. But I presume you also inevitably feel a kind of guilt that you didn't spot it earlier, or could you have done this, or should you have done the other? Can you come to terms with that?
Well, it's not spotting it. It's kind of little things that you feel might have made a difference, like being able to send him to America when he wanted to go with his girlfriend and only asked us the day before if we could give him the money. Sort of things that if you disappointed a person who grew up perfectly normally, you wouldn't think twice about, but it's little things that always make one feel badly. And not being there, not being able to help him further. And also, but the dreadful thing is to see someone suffer that you love.
And he died 13 years ago now, didn't
he?
Yes. Perhaps the cruelest thing of all, it seems to me, reading about what you've written about him, is that you couldn't be allowed to see his body or photographs, and so you could never be completely sure, I suppose. And
that's
so
right.
You went on for some time thinking that maybe
yes.
You saw him.
You still do, partly. We were at the airport last year, my husband and I, and there he was. I mean, not as he would be now, but as he was when he died. Exactly the same person with his slightly sloping shoulders, and his hair was the same, and the look on his face was the same. And people say it's like being dropped into cold water. Well, it was like that. Both of us stood actually frozen. But, of course, it wasn't him.
Record number 6.
One of the things my husband always complained about my lack of musical understanding was that I wouldn't, when he commissioned things for the proms, I wouldn't enjoy the modern music. So I have seriously tried to enjoy modern music. And this is a piece I like, which is by my first husband's son from his second marriage, who writes modern music but is still linked to the past, I think. And also it is lyrical.
one of Rupert Borden's two studies for orchestra on scenes from Berulle's Romance of Tristan, played by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Rupert Borden. And we should explain that your second husband, Nina Borden, Austin Clark, was managing director of the BBC's World Service.
Yes.
There's a schizophrenic boy in Circles of Deceit, your novel, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 87, which proves, I suppose, that no personal experience is sacrosanct to the novelist.
What happened was that he crept into the book without my... He was dead by then. He crept into the book without my intending it. It just seemed tasteless to dismiss him. It would have been a dreadful thing. I mean, it does happen just occasionally to writers, sometimes, that something happens they hadn't quite intended.
But the difference is he just doesn't die anymore.
He doesn't die because I couldn't bear to kill him off for the sake of the story.
You've written, too, going back to the point that you write about your own experiences, you've written about your experience as a magistrate on the bench in Afternoon of a Good Woman. What about Family Money, which is about the greed of families to inherit their aged parents' houses? Is that something that you felt for your mother or that you fear your children feel for you?
No. It arose, really, from something quite else. Going to a party where there were lots of people in their 40s and they were all talking in the 80s about the amazing amounts of money they were making as the values of their houses rose and rose and rose. I mean, they spoke about nothing else, not books, not music, nor politics. It seemed to be rather dreadful. It didn't happen in my family like that, and I had no direct experience of something like this happening. But I could see that it could, and it was a lovely fun to do.
Number 7.
Well, this is something I heard in Dubrovnik, before that lovely city was bombed, before all the dreadful things that happened to Yugoslavia. We were staying near Dubrovnik in a hotel that was frequented much by diplomats, and this was the time of Watergate, and it was August, and we were lying on the rocks by the sea, listening to Nixon resign. And Austin thought perhaps he ought to go and tell the American ambassador, or his deputy it may have been, that his president had resigned. And so he did so. And after that, all the time we were there, people came up doffing their caps. It gave one a wonderful feeling of power. And in the evenings, we went off to Dubrovnik, which, as I say, was beautiful and unbombed. And one evening we sat and heard this lovely cello. It was in the cloisters somewhere, and it was a magical, wonderful sound, and it mixed with the holiday, with Dubrovnik, with this feeling of being able to tell ambassadors things.
The Bourrée from Bach's Suite No. 3 in C major for cello, played by Paul Tortelier. Have you an image of how it would be for you, Nina, on this desert island? I mean, in the deeper sense of coming to terms with a solitary existence.
I'd like to think I like my own company, but I'm not sure. I suppose I'd just go around talking to the crabs in the end. I mean, I would address culls. Oh, gull! Things like this. I think I'd have to talk to the other living creatures and maybe they would talk to me eventually.
Plenty of material in it, though. I mean, you've talked about not wanting to waste any bit of your life, any corner of your life. You want to use it all in your writing, so there's plenty of...
I suppose it depends how comfortable I am. If I've got to sort of make my own food and my own fires and that sort of thing, I'm not sure that I would have much time for communing with myself.
Can I ask you finally... how proud you are. Difficult question, this, really, but you've written, I think, 19 novels and...
20, I think.
20 novels and...
And an autobiography and 18 children's books.
And you're not finished yet.
No.
Do you feel you've done yourself justice? Do you feel rightly proud of yourself, I think, is what I'm asking.
I don't know. I don't think it ever occurred to me to ask myself that question.
But you feel
I'm
pleased?
I'm always pleased when a book does well. And of course I'm proud of them. I'm proud of them rather than me.
Last record.
The last record is a Greek one because we have, since Austin retired, we have a house in the Peloponnesus and we go there for 5 months of the year. And, of course, Greek music is very much a part of life in Greece. This is a song about Smyrna. And I like this one because it reminds me of Nathalia.
Στην καρδιά μου ανθίζουν λουλούδια χίλια όσα όσες μικρές ενθύμησες που δεν τις λέει η γλώσσα όσες μικρές ενθύμησες που δεν τις λέει η γλώσσα. Σμύρνη πατρίδα μου γλυκιά, χαριταμένη χώρα, για να σε βγάλω από το νου, ποτέ δεν θα έρθει η ώρα, για να σε βγάλω από το νου, ποτέ δεν θα έρθει η ώρα.
A Greek song called Smyrna. Which of those 8 records, Nina, would you take if you could only take one?
I think I'll take the Beethoven, because there's quite a lot in that, and there's voices as well as music, isn't there? So I could play which bit I wanted.
Symphony number 9. What about your book?
Well, I think perhaps there's no question I shall have to take The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. I've been trying to read it for many years, and I would manage it at last.
Is there a sense of shame there that you haven't got to it?
A certain sense of shame. I have read it in an abbreviated edition, and I gather there's another abbreviated edition that is better.
But we give you the whole lot.
You'd give us the whole 8 volumes.
Yes, absolutely.
Good. Oh, yes, well, that's fine. I should be very much more educated when I'd finished.
What about your luxury?
I should like an unlimited supply of nice, plain paper and an unlimited supply of very good pilot ballpoints. And I will need some kind of plastic folder to keep them, perhaps several plastic folders. It depends how long I'm going to be there.
You're expecting rain, are you?
Well, you never know. Oh, it's rain, it's dust, it's sand.
Nina Borden, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Well, thank you for letting me come.
Thank you.